Good evening. My name is Alex Fox and I'm Director of Tate Britain, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you here tonight and to introduce tonight's event. I'll be very brief because both speakers will be very well known to you. Most of you will have already seen, I'm sure, Don's extraordinary exhibition here at Tate Britain. The response from the public and online and by the press has really been overwhelming. Which is a tribute to the aesthetic and moral power of Don's work and the importance of what it makes us see. It's a true honour to be presenting 10 decades of Don's photography here at Tate Britain. The work for which McCullen is best known first appeared in British newspapers in the 60s, 70s and 80s, most of all in the pages of the Sunday Times. It's fitting then that Don is joined tonight by Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times, a role he's held since 2005, having worked at the FT since the 80s. As a young reporter, Lionel overlapped at the Sunday Times with Don. And I expect they'll both have something to say about the changes to British journalism that have occurred since that time. Specializing in business and politics, the closest Lionel says he's come to war reporting has been the riots in Brixton, 81, and the riots in LA in 92. There's a theme there. Many of you will also know that Lionel Barber is chairman of our board of trustees. We're more used to seeing him wear here. So it's a pleasure to have the prospect of seeing him exercise his journalistic chops here tonight with Don. The format for tonight's conversation is that Don Lionel will be speaking for the best part of an hour. There'll then be about half an hour for questions from all of you, and then you're all invited to join us for a reception in the foyer outside where we'll be serving wine till 8:45, and during which Don has kindly agreed to sign catalogues. I should also say that we're recording tonight's events and archiving it and no doubt be putting it online. So thank you all for joining us this evening, and over to Don and Lionel. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Alex, for that gracious introduction. It's an extraordinary pleasure and privilege to be interviewing Don McCullen tonight. And Don, I just want to say what a wonderful exhibition this is at Tate. We're going to talk about that. Okay. You mentioned, Alex, that we both worked for a legendary editor of the Sunday Times, Harry Evans, now Sir Harold Evans. And I contacted Harry, who lives in New York, last night. He's been a friend and mentor for 40 years. And I said, well, I'm going to interview Don McCullen. And Harry, now in his 90s, alert as ever, sent me something to reflect upon. And here's how an editor really should write. The legendary Don McCullen, 50 years in and between every battle line, beaten by Idi Amin's thugs, gassed in Northern Ireland, wounded by a shell in Cambodia, assaulted on the streets of Beirut, under fire in Vietnam, the AK bullet meant for his heart, intercepted by his camera. He still hears the drumbeat of war. At 77, he was in Syria. At 79, in northern Iraq. I treat my life as though I'm on a tightrope. That's Don, in his own words, and that's Harry Evans. Now, we're going to talk about that extraordinary career, which continues. But Don, I want to start with your roots. You're very proud of your North London roots. And it was in North London that you took that first picture which launched 1,000 catalogues. Oh. Let's just look at it. It is the gang, the governors, in their Sunday suits. Tell us about, the origin of the picture, and then let's deconstruct it a bit and why it's such a powerful picture for you. And us.
The origins is that I came out of my national service 2 years in the Royal Air Force, travelled around the Middle East, Africa, and then I wound up in Cyprus for the end of my time in the Air Force. And all these countries were struggling for their independence. So I wasn't welcome in any of those countries. You know, people were out to kill you. And so I did buy a camera, and I took it back. But a camera in this environment wasn't the normal thing, because the day I took it out on the streets, the police stopped me and said, get in this car, you know, we've heard there's a stolen camera in the area. But, of course, the mentality of the police, you know, you expected that where I lived. So the camera was left in the house and not used. It was a lovely German Rollycord camera. And then one Sunday afternoon, the boys said, you know, why don't you go and get that camera? You never get that camera. You never take any pictures. So I ran up to the house and got the camera, and I came down. I loaded a roll of Ilford film, I think it was called FP3, and I knew the exposure, because I never had an exposure meter, was 125th F11, and I saw this building, which was the end of my street. It's in North London, a place called Finsbury Park. And I said, jump up into that building. Well, the extraordinary thing is, it's not so much the composition, it's the fact they're all wearing suits and ties. One of them, the boy sitting down, actually did some time for armed robbery. So it was just an amazing kind of experience for me. I just said, jump up there. I mean, I didn't arrange it. I said, get up there. And I took the picture. I took one negative, and accidentally, several years ago, I found it, and it was folded in half under a load of other negatives. But I've made the most beautiful prints from this negative, despite its being folded in half. And but really, this was the picture that the Observer used subsequently, because the boys involved in a gang warfare with another gang of boys from Islington cost the lives of a policeman on a Sunday night. He came to stop the fight. I wasn't there. And the other boy from the other gang stabbed the policeman, and he died at the end of my road in Seven Sisters, North London. So my whole career basically kicked off because the Observer newspaper used this picture. But it kicked off on a theme of violence, and I've been involved in violence for the last 60-odd years.
We're going to come to that. Just tell us, were they easily ordered around, the governors, and how long did it take you to take the photograph?
I think
it
took me a split second to take the picture. Yeah. People in those days, you see, they were vain. I mean, being in a poor district like this, nobody owned cameras. You'd have to go to a local shop called Jerome's, who made paper negatives, and you went there officially to record part of your history in life. You know, I went there as a one-year-old baby, and people took their children, and they made a lovely portrait of you with a paper negative, and it cost you about 1 and 6 pence, which is like 15p in today's money, I think.
Let's move from North London Reservoir Dogs to Berlin. Because this is a very interesting story of where, on your own initiative, you went to that divided capital and suddenly history was unfolding before your camera.
Well, it was very important, the history. 1961, it looked like the beginning of a possible World War III. And I was with my wife in Paris. We'd not long been married, but we'd never had a honeymoon. So I said, let's go to Paris for the weekend. And we went, and I saw a man reading a newspaper. There was a huge photograph of an East German soldier jumping into the West with his Kalashnikov, his helmet, his whole uniform. And it was a very famous photograph, and I wish I'd have taken it. And I said to my wife, when we go home, would you mind if I went to Berlin? And I had £70 in the bank. I've always tried to save a penny or two. And she said, no, of course not. So I rang the Observer, and they said, we're not interested. And I said, well, I've bought the ticket. And they said, well, we'll give you the address of the correspondent. So I went, I arrived at Tempelhof Airport, Hitler's personal airport. And I went to the hotel to contact the journalist, but he wasn't there. And there was a beautiful young woman there, and she said, why are you here? And I said, it's none of your business. She said, well, where are you staying? And I said, nowhere. She said, I'll find you somewhere. And she took me to a boarding house. An old lady rented rooms, and I got a room there. And then I went down to the wall at Friedrichstrasse. I hadn't by then met the correspondent. So I went to Friedrichstrasse. I had the same camera. I took the picture of the gang. all the pictures I took, I had to put the camera on the floor, put it up in the air, do all kinds of things, because it was a square format. But it made wonderful pictures. And this is my attempt to show. But I really like the woman in the photograph, because I like the way she's dressed. She's incredibly well-dressed, and she looks like a Dior model coming down the road. And it's a strange connivance, this composition.
It really is. I mean, the jack boot, or the heavy boot.
Yes.
Were you aware of the symbolism? Were you looking around for that?
No, I wasn't really a photographer, to be truthful. I never studied photography. I was in the Royal Air Force, and I used to print 3,000 aerial pictures at night when I was in Africa. And when I left the Air Force, I failed the test to become a photographer. I actually failed the trade test based on the fact I couldn't read the theory paper.
You're dyslexic.
Very. To this day, I'm very dyslexic. But I took my pictures home, and then the Observer kind of said, well, we'll show us those pictures. And they saw the pictures, they printed the pictures, and they gave me a contract for 15 guineas for 2 days' work a week. And I really thought at that point, my life's about to take off.
Yeah, you believed that you were going to make it.
Yes, but I still wasn't a photographer. I don't know why, but I when you hear voices in your head, you need to see a psychiatrist or something. But I really believe that somebody was telling me emotionally, do this, do that. And that's why I went to Berlin. That's why I photographed the boys in the building, because I've been guided by this incredible blessing. And yet I don't have, I didn't have an education. I didn't have any knowledge of photography. I've got it now.
I believe you, Don, really. Don, let's switch to war, because the next photograph is the beginning of real distress, anguish, raw. There's a rawness in these photographs. There's also in that second one, which I'd love you to talk about. This is Cyprus.
Yes.
What was Cyprus like in 61?
Well, Cyprus was... I finished my Royal Air Force training at just a few miles from Limassol, where the man on the right-hand side. I was there for the last 6 months of my service in the Air Force, so I walked into the Observer office on a Friday morning to do one of my 2 days, and the editor looked at me in a quizzical way, and he said, how would you consider going to the civil war in Cyprus? And I really thought for the first time in my life I could levitate. I thought I was lifting up with joy. I couldn't believe what he was saying. And so I got on a plane and went to Cyprus, and I teamed up with the ecclesiastical correspondent, a man called Ivan Yates, who sadly died in a road crash in Swiss Cottage many years later. So we went off to Limassol, and we were driving through the city, and we could hear this terrible barking noise. And I said, I was driving the car, it was a hire car, and I said, Ivan, I think the exhaust has fallen off the car. So I got out of the car, went round the back and looked underneath the car. The exhaust was perfectly okay, but it was a Bren gun firing across our car into this part of the Turkish quarter. So Ivan said, I've got a dinner appointment in Limassol tonight. I don't want to stay here. And I said, I drove out of the cauldron, got rid of Ivan and came back, and I came to the Turkish quarter, which was under heavy gunfire. I was so excited. I was just running around like a mad dog. I was just running around, and I didn't know how to focus on why I was there, what was expected of me. I was so excited, and I wasn't afraid of the gunfire. I was afraid of not calming down and getting the pictures. But I was arrested by the Turkish police, and they put me in jail for the night. They didn't lock the door. They said, it's just for your own safety. You can go in the morning. And I woke up in the morning, and a bullet struck the iron grill on the window. And I thought, the war is still on. Because wars, sometimes they start, and then they stop. Mm-hmm. And your biggest fear as a man covering a war for a newspaper is that it's all going to stop, and you're going to go back to your editor and say it didn't work out.
Yeah, except we know colleagues, David Blundy,
yes,
and others who shot in action, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Just go to this picture here, Don. Did you, when you took that picture of the grieving Turkish woman, mm-hmm, did you feel you were intruding?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't have the God-given right, because we have a camera and we work for a newspaper. I mean, if somebody did this to me, if I had a grieving situation like this, I would probably fly at them. I mean, there are different nationalities that treat their grieving in a different way. I've noticed in the Middle East time and time again that people, they express themselves publicly in a way that they even beat their own faces, women, when they're crying. And I've seen it with my own eyes. But this woman had just been told that her husband was found under an orange tree. And they have dews in the Middle East. You know, the night becomes wet like it does in the countryside. And they found her dead. I saw her husband's body. He was crouched under an orange tree, dead, in a kind of fetal position. So they told this woman, and her son, as you can see, is involved here. And I stood in front of this woman, and I thought, this is what I'm supposed to do. Nobody said I'm supposed to do this, but I felt that that's what I was supposed to do. There was another photographer next to me. He got almost the same picture, but he didn't get this picture. And so I don't know why, but I don't think for a second I gained any pleasure out of standing in front of people's grief, because it's deadly uncomfortable.
But did you linger, or did you, in the back of your mind, said, I've got to get out of this place?
When I do these things, I behave like a mime artist. I kind of mime without speaking. It doesn't mean to say for a second I don't have emotion. The first dead person I saw in my life was my father at the age of 13. So I know, I've been there. I know what it means to lose somebody in the family and how it affects you. But in a way, this woman was oblivious of me, and I took advantage of this moment.
Let's go to Vietnam. I want to read something that Harry wrote, talking about war. He describes in the beginning of an essay the predicament of three different photographers in war zones. One was in Bosnia, in Bjelovina, another was in Central African Republic, and another in Liberia's civil war. And in the CAR story, he says, you, that is the photographer, come across a group of people, a few of them journalists like you, looking down on a gravely wounded man. Your instinct is to join them in an effort to save his life. You suppress it, and he dies. Now, you've been in that position, haven't you?
The trouble about being a photographer is that you have a camera. You're not a doctor. You go to places where people are waiting for doctors, and they're waiting for food. They don't need you, really. And I remember walking into a camp in Biafra during the civil war in Biafra. It was a cunning move by the eastern Igbos. They thought they would grab the eastern area where the oil was, and a million people died. They died of starvation, which is possibly the worst death of all. And you walked into a school complex with 600 or 700 dying children, and they, as soon as they see you, they think, ah, this man's a white man. He's obviously from an aid agency. He's bringing us, you know, food. But I was bringing them two Nikon cameras. Mm. And then I had to stand and photograph that. I needn't have got on the aeroplane at London Airport in the first place if I had... it doesn't make me callous, because I did get on the aeroplane. I did go and stand in front of these children. I paid for it, for the rest of my life, because I still see those children in my pre-dreaming kind of sleep at night. They're there in my house.
But do you think, if we just go back to Vietnam, and you spent a lot of time with embedded with soldiers.
Not embedded in those days.
Not embeds, yeah.
It was a new thing, embedded, yeah.
Yes, but you certainly were in the front line. Did you feel the need to develop personal relationships with these soldiers?
You can't...
And when do you decide?
Well, I did decide. One of the pictures in the exhibition is a picture of a man with his arms out. I call it my crucifixion. He's being supported by two soldiers. One of them later got killed 2 days later. But I think it's a very religious kind of image of this man. I call it my crucifixion. It is like Jesus Christ. But I said to them, bring him to me, because there was an alleyway where all the fire was coming. And they ran with him, and they fell with him. So already his injury was, injured again with great pain, and I felt so bad. So I put my cameras down, and I got him on my back and took him away from the battle. And he wrote his mother a letter. He was sent to a place called Guam, which were all the B-52 bombers would load up and bomb North Vietnam. They sent him there to convalesce and get better. And he wrote his mother a letter saying, this strange Englishman picked me up and carried me away. I have a copy of the letter because he sent it to me. And he came back to Vietnam and got a bullet through the lung 6 months later. But you do not become their buddies. You don't become their comrade. You are a total outsider to soldiers because you haven't bonded with them as in a brotherly way. You're not one of them. So I was always on the periphery, scrounging food from them. But the moment I did this act of, I suppose you could call it kindness, but it was out of guilt I did it, they changed their attitude towards me. Mm. They didn't treat me any different, but they showed a little bit more respect. And one of the soldiers came up to me and said, they always address you as sir, because you had a complimentary rank of major. Having failed my RAF test and, you know, suddenly becoming a major was quite a turnaround. But one of the men came one day and said, listen, sir, would you like a weapon? They were offering me a 45 revolver, and I said, it's against the Geneva Convention, and I wouldn't want one anyway. So, but I spent nearly 12 days with these people at this particular company that totally decimated by an enemy which was not my enemy. No one was my enemy. The only enemy I had was if one of my cameras would go wrong or my exposure meter was telling me lies. I had no enemies in war.
But as a journalist, you and I know that one of the challenges is to avoid being co-opted. But at the same time, to be, a good reporter and perhaps also a great photographer, you need to have a certain empathy.
Yes.
Now, how hard is that in the conflict zone?
Well, it was easy, actually. And when you say that a word like it's easy, it said, oh, here he goes, he's going to start bragging now. I'm not. I went with a camera, but the camera was immaterial to me. It did the job. You know, I used to make lots of cocky statements when I was young. I said once...
You were cocky.
Not particularly, but I was trying to build a confidence in my fear. I had fear, believe me. I didn't go there and make out I wasn't afraid. I was terrified. I picked a man up once who had no face left. I don't know how you would continue your life with half your face missing. But what I'm getting at here is just that I operated not as a photographer. I certainly wasn't a journalist because I didn't write. I wasn't an artist.
I was a photojournalist, though.
Well, that's what they call it. But I was just a photographer, really, and a carrier pigeon. But what I'm getting at was I operated totally as a decent human being. You know, if you cannot have an emotional commitment to taking these pictures, they won't look the same, your pictures. They will look like atrocity pictures or maybe even glamour. This picture almost glamorizes war, this grenade thrower. And this old man, he's an old man now in a wheelchair living in Chicago. He had a stroke and he's in a wheelchair. He's 70 years of age. We've tracked him down. So history has a very kind of strange way of moving very fast in a human being's life. All of a sudden, I was 31 years of age there when I took this picture, and I'm nearly 84 years of age now. So to talk about this picture that is so old, the man in the picture is history like me.
But there's a, dare I say it, a writer on psychology who Harry pointed me to, who came up with this concept of moral injury. It's not the same as post-traumatic stress disorder, because that's a psychiatric trick, but it's there. You are there, you're seeing the suffering, and you are suffering inside yourself.
I suffered guilt more than suffering. Yeah. I mean, sleeping on the ground next to dead bodies was kind of commonplace. One day I slept in a shack, and I always used to go out that way, and one day I went that way, and behind where I was sleeping, which was a wall, was a dead North Vietnamese soldier, and we'd been sleeping almost side by side, divided by a wall. And I thought, this is part of the madness of war, you know, the insanity of why am I here when I could be photographing something beautiful somewhere else?
Oh, no, this is getting very dark and deep, but let's just talk about the practice of photography. And, of course, in those days, you didn't have a digital camera that you could quickly have a look at what you'd taken. So when did you get to see the photographs that you'd actually made? I mean, there you are out in the front line. How did it work?
The biggest problem about being in a war and using old-fashioned cameras was loading the camera. And sometimes there were a lot of fire going over me. I would lie on my back and almost load my camera on my chest as if I was involved in a braille situation. It was all done with a sensitive way, and the bullets would be flying over. But the thing about me is that I knew I was in the right place. When I heard gunfire, I knew I was in the right place. You know, this battle went on for nearly 2 weeks, and when I came out of it, I looked like one of the people in the battle. I didn't take my clothes off for nearly 2 weeks, and I went back to the press center in Da Nang, and I took my clothes off and threw them in the waste bin and stood under the shower, and I wasn't sure whether I was weeping or it was the water running down my face. Mm. I've never suffered from post-traumatic stress. I don't to this day. I have a huge memory of all this stuff, and it torments me all the time, even in the daytime. But that night, I knew that I was on the edge of a huge breakdown.
Yeah. Did you sleep at night?
I was so exhausted because I've been living like an animal under tin shacks and things like that. And I'd lost a bit of weight, and yet I was coming back to the film. I had 28 rolls of film. I lost 2 rolls of film one day. They, by the way, my clothing, you see the jacket the man's wearing. I had to go to the field hospital, scrounge a jacket, scrounge a helmet. I had no equipment to protect myself. Mm. And so one day I was lying down and I could see men being killed. One of the men I told you about in the crucifixion picture, I saw him being killed. I saw another man being killed. And I thought this sniper was going to get all of us. And I was lying down in the dirt and I dropped 2 rolls of film out of my bullet. I never stopped thinking about those 2 rolls of film to this day. It's a torment, and because I risked my life getting those 2 rolls of film. I still think about it today. But, I mean, it was no great loss if I think about it, because I don't think for a second, and you mention colleagues of mine on the Sunday Times who lost their lives, I don't think it was worth losing my life to get a good film, a good negative. There's no question your life is much more valuable than an image, really.
Let's move to photography back here home after these. I'd like to, yes, Aldgate East. Actually, the picture I wanted was the cop grabbing. No, it will go back to Northern Ireland. This one, no, the next one, the coal diggers. This picture's 1972. I mean, it could almost be 1872.
Well,
how did you find this?
Well, what I used to do, I used to come back from war, and I used to say, it wasn't because I thought I was losing my marbles, but I used to say to myself, I've got to find who I am and where I come from myself. I'm losing my identity. And there was a very famous photographer called Bill Brandt who I met. He was an emigre from Germany, from the Nazi Germany period. And he always used to go to the north of England and photograph. It was, in a way, taking advantage of the people of the north of England away. We would go there and photograph them and come back safely to the south, where we were, you know, slightly better off than those people. And I had a guilt about these people. I thought, these are men unemployed. They were scraping for coal dust, which they got 10p a sack. 10p wouldn't even buy you a matchstick. And they didn't want to be photographed because they were probably on the dole as well. But they were very nice, these people. I mean, you could not see a more depraved scene than those men clawing with their hands to make a living. And I thought, hang on a minute, don't we live in the 20th century, and shouldn't this have all been levelled off, because the people in the north of England have always always been the backbone of our nation, and they've always had the shortest kind of reward in their lives. And they were laughing, some of them, really. But, you know, if I was in their position, I wouldn't laugh at myself having to degrade myself like that. And the north of England, I could take you there today and I could find you similar scenes. We still haven't sorted out the social balance in this country.
Describe those scenes that you've seen
today. If you go to the city of Bradford, which became one of my hunting grounds, because I could walk through the city of Bradford not every day of the week, but when I would turn a corner, I would see something extraordinary. I mean, in the exhibition, I think there's a picture of a young girl taking the family laundry in a wheelbarrow. None of that fazed me, because I grew up in a very similar background in North London. I used to wear other people's clothes. My mother would always go to the second-hand shop at the weekends when they brought a new dollop of clothes, and she'd fish something out and beat it to death in the sink, and I'd wear it to go to school. So when I saw these people in the north of England, I was shocked. But I thought, hang on a minute, didn't you grow up like that? Mm. I thought I was qualified to understand what I was photographing, particularly in my own country.
How much did you have to negotiate the terms of engagement?
On this occasion, nothing. I mean, I didn't have to bung these guys any money.
Is that because you have one of these kind of faces that just encourages people to trust you?
When I was a young child, I always thought I looked like Hitler Youth. I had a shock of blonde hair, and my mother used to buy kind of second-hand clothes that looked like kind of uniforms. And,
there's a bit of a similar...
There was a very famous photographer once called Helmut Newton, and he said, I want to take a portrait of you, look up. And I said, this reminds me of Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of Will. Are you not going down the Hitler road? He said, shut up. I do have a sympathetic face, and... people have somehow trusted me, really. They don't see any danger in my eyes. Mm. The only trouble is, as a young man in England, you know, you're sometimes challenged by other young men. Mm. So I've had to change my appearance occasionally. I mean, on the train yesterday, somebody hit me with one of those things on their back, a holder, and I wish they'd take them off, hit me in the face. And I thought, I'm going to say something to this guy, but he was younger than me. So there is challenge in me, particularly about injustice. That is injustice.
Yeah. Let's go back to Aldgate.
Ah, okay.
How did you find that picture?
I think this was 1970. I was coming in from Liverpool Street Station, and I looked down from the viaduct just as the train sneaked into the platform parking, and I could see these groups of people. And I went into the Sunday Times, and I said to my art director, I think we should do something about homeless people. This is in 1971. And as you know, today the situation is even more chronic. I mean, every time I drive through London now, I see people sleeping, not in doorways, they're actually sleeping in front of Selfridges and amazing places like that. I'm convinced a lot of it's to do with what these men were suffering. These were men who were thrown out of institutions, who were mentally looking after them with medicine and stuff like that. So they were chucked out on the streets. This reminds me of my Berlin picture. It's yet another stylish woman coming down the road. This man, you know, he's a lost soul. And Aldgate in 1970, particularly in that amazing kind of almost Hogarthian area. I was thinking of William Hogarth when I had taken these pictures. Mm. I've seen those drawings of Hogarth. They're the kind of lost people, the cast-out people, the people who know they're so down the social scale, they think they've got nothing to lose.
And you have a great empathy for them.
Well, I'm not going to be a liar here. I'm going to tell you, I know a good picture when I see it, and it often circles around stuff like this. I'm not going to sit here and be deceitful to you tonight. You know, a photographer, we're quite cunning people. We know what is a great picture and what is a normal, you know, mundane picture. And of course, you know, with all the honesty that I've tried to walk that tight line, that thin line, I know when I put the camera to my eye, it's going to give me this kind of picture.
Because, Don, I mean, I'm just making this up, but there you were, waiting for the elegant brunette to come down and thinking of that great scene in Midnight Cowboy on Fifth Avenue.
It's very strange. I've tried to avoid people wagging the finger at me and saying, should you have done this, should you have done that? But, you know, this situation, I did those pictures all those years ago. It hasn't changed the situation. Neither has any of the work I did in the war zones. Nothing has changed. As soon as one war is finished, this ISIS thing has been crushed for the moment. But something else will come along. I never thought I would see men being thrown off of buildings who are being accused of being gay. And 9 times out of 10, when people are settling old scores, they would use this occasion to get back at their neighbours. So I don't trust humanity.
Well, so you've confessed tonight, that you are waiting for the right image, or you have a sensitivity to that, of course. But do you also harbour inside the hope that your photography, simply through its power, will have some impact on the way people think and behave?
It does have impact. It has impact on the converted, sadly. It doesn't have any impact in Westminster or Washington or places where the people create these wars. I mean, it's not just politicians. You have religious wars. I covered the war in Beirut in 1976, where I saw Christian Falan soldiers killing groups of Palestinians, just mowing them down in front of me. And I stood there with my mouth wide open. I couldn't believe what I was watching. And I didn't take the picture. I've seen lots of men executed, but they don't invite you to be their guest of their murder. And if my editor at the time would have known that I didn't press that button, I think there would have been words in his office. He would have said, well, why are you there if you can't bring yourself to take that picture?
But how many times have you not pressed the button?
Several times.
Several?
Several times.
Not dozens?
Oh, I could say a dozen, I could say several, I could say 100. I've seen so many people murdered. I don't really think that justifies me, indulging in murder. What would I get out of it? I mean, what would I get? I'd get an amazing picture of a man. They cry in front of you, people, when they're being murdered. They think you can save them, and you can't. And they look at you they look at you with disgust at the same time. They say, why is this man standing with his camera? So it's an incredibly uncomfortable place to be.
Indeed. Let's go to the Irish backstop. Perhaps this will remind people of what it was like in Northern Ireland.
Well, if it wasn't for the woman in the doorway, it wouldn't be that much of a picture, really. It's just her shock at... these soldiers used to hate me because I would go to stay on the stone-throwing side of the other side, and then I would have to walk through the army lines, and they would swear and say terrible things to me. And I can understand that. They think, I was... they called me a traitor and all kinds of swear words and things like that. So you're not always loved by everybody in this world. But, I spent 6 weekends, and then one day the editor said to me, he rang up my house and said, Dom, I think we want you to go to Ireland this weekend. We're doing a thing about the paras. And so I rang somebody, and he said, yes, in Ireland. He said, yeah, get here for this weekend. It's going to be very lively. And then my editor rang back, the features editor, and said, by the way, we don't want you to go this weekend, and I miss Bloody Sunday.
Was that Don?
Pardon?
That wasn't Don Berry, was it? Who was the...
No, I must have mentioned his name. But frankly speaking...
Well, we want some accountability here.
Why should I be at every killing?
Yeah.
Every event? I mean, was I the grand toastmaster of death? And was I the grim reaper? And I never went to the war in Serbia. And I think I never went to the war in Chechnya, where I would have quite liked the war in Chechnya because it was so dangerous. I used to test myself, and and as I got older, I used to be afraid more and more because I thought, well, I can't run as fast anymore. I was in Syria 4 years ago, and the incoming shells were terrible. And I went to a place which was the hospital, and a truck arrived, and there was a man sitting on the truck, and he was looking at me, and he had a big overcoat on, bitterly cold. And the truck stopped, and they started taking very badly wounded. And I thought, why doesn't this man get off the truck? And he was looking at me, and I thought, why is he looking at me? And the reason was he was looking at me was he was sitting, by the way, because he was propped up by another wounded, but the man was dead. And he was looking at me. And, I had to go away, and I'm talking about it tonight because that man is still looking at me.
But you said you would have liked to go to Chechnya. I mean, yeah. Chechnya was really dangerous.
Well, it was soldiers.
I mean, was that you because you wanted to go to kind of the next level of danger? I mean, we thought, having had your insides knocked out in Cambodia and being roughed up badly by the Edema, I mean, why do you want to go to the next level?
I think I was slightly sick, you see. I, when you go to war, it's quite exciting. I have to say this without reservation. Until you get over the fact that other people's lives are at risk and you are going home to your family and to the comfort of your own safety and home. And there's no doubt about it. I looked at my colleagues and I could see we were all suffering from this kind of junkie situation. We were excited and it was almost criminally wrong because we were getting off on this kind of stuff. And I was weaned, remember, for my age, on Hollywood films where people fell in the most amazing way when they were shot and it was classic Hollywood. I had to bring back pictures that were not classic Hollywood. And when I went to the Belgian Congo and I saw captured, they were called Jeunesse warriors, they were 14, 15-year-old boys who were Lumumbist. And by the way, let's remember, Lumumba was the elected prime minister.
Patrice.
Even if he was left-wing. So these young boys they captured, I was with the mercenaries, they were torturing them. They were dragging them behind trucks on strings and skinning them alive and then shooting them in the back of the head. I was there illegally, and I brought my camera out and took a few pictures which are in the exhibition, and then one of the mercenaries came over and said, Who are you? What are you doing? Where have you come from? And I said, okay, I'm from the Observer newspaper. And they said, oh, you're in big trouble. But in fact, they didn't hand me over to the gendarmerie, the Belgians, who were... And by the way, the Belgian Congo, if you've read Leopold's Ghost, it's never been stabilised. It's always been cruelty from the word go.
Let's turn lastly to something a little more relaxing. Apart from the skies, of course, which are truly Wagnerian. Just tell us, was this a kind of safety valve for you?
Well,
or something more, I suspect.
Well, I started needing, I didn't need the psychiatrist. I've always said if I ever needed a psychiatrist, I'd make him pay me for the visit, because I could tell him some really bad stories. But I have a romantic streak in me, which has probably been the blessing and when I get in my darkroom, of course, I really print my pictures dark, as you would have seen next door. But I had this notion to do a book about the Roman Empire. You can't do all of it. There's not enough time in life. And whatever you do, you're scratching the surface. So I was with a very famous writer called Bruce Chatwin. We were in Algeria donkeys years ago, just before he died. And we were in a small Roman town. And when he died, I was at a crossroads in life, and I thought, what can I do? I thought, I know, I'm going to do something about the Romans. So I went to my publishers, and I said, I'd like to do this. And there was an awful lot of yawning when I was talking to them, because they didn't want me to do it, and they didn't want me to have the advance to do it. So I managed to persuade them, and I wanted to do a book about the Roman cities in North Africa. I thought it was a wonderful idea. So I went to the embassy in London, and they were mocking me. They were saying, oh, no, we can't give you a visa. No, and you mustn't tell them you're involved in media. I went to the consulate, and they were fooling around with me for days and days. So I went to the embassy, and I got an audience with the cultural secretary.
This is the Algerian embassy?
Algerian. Yeah. I told you this earlier, but he said to me, Mr. McCullen, you haven't been entirely honest with us, because I told them I was retired, and they must have Googled me or something. I think they Googled and then he said, but I'm going to give you the visa. I'm going to make sure. So I arrived in Algeria, and I thought, you clever devil, you've done this. You're in Algeria now. And the moment I walked through passport control after having been stamped, they confiscated my cameras for 4 days. So life is not, you know, as a photographer, you're always trying to get over these barriers and hurdles. But coming back to this picture, this was one of the pictures in the book when I eventually finished it. I had a love affair with Hadrian's Wall, And on this particular day, a blizzard had just swept across the wall, and I jumped down into a little place to hide, and I had some bananas and a flask of coffee, and I couldn't have been more happy. And I jumped up and I took this picture. But while I was taking the picture, I thought, what kind of Mediterranean would have been standing here in one of those Roman kilts in this weather? But he wouldn't have been Roman, of course. He would have probably been German or Serbian or some.
But at what moment in your career did you think, actually, I really need to take a break and I would like to photograph landscapes as opposed to raw human suffering?
1991, I decided I wanted to do landscape photography, and I had an old garden shed where I would do still life pictures in the back, which obviously sounds incredibly pretentious, but I'd looked at some of the old paintings of the Dutch masters, and I thought, you know, I would cut out bits and pieces of the Dutch masters, and I'd try to shove my things together, and I would go around the hedgerows where I live in Somerset, and I would bring back sloes and elderberries and horse mushrooms, and I collaborated them with, I have a very nice collection of bronzes, Buddhist bronzes of all people, Buddhist, for the hell of a life I've seen. And let's not remind ourselves of, forget what's been going on with the Rohingyas in, you know, a Buddhist nation. And I was in Sri Lanka a few weeks ago, another Buddhist nation which had the most appalling war. So there am I clinging to my Buddhist notion that, you know, they bring peace. So I created these. And then someone said, you know, trouble is those landscapes, those still lives of yours, they look like religious altars. And it wasn't about criticism, really.
Because you're obviously not religious.
I'm not a religious person. I can't afford to be religious. I don't kill anything. I don't kill a spider. If I see a spider in the bathtub, I help him out. I just have a fear that if I do something bad will happen to me. I've never killed another man. I've never injured another person to my
recollection. But in these terrible conflict zones, and having seen what you've seen, did you never ever have a little glimmer of wanting to believe in God?
No.
Something higher?
The day my father died, I wrote in my autobiography, I gave up God. And when you see 600 dying children in a camp in Biafra, you give up God. You give up any religion. You can't believe that, you know, there's no such faith that can sustain you through a day like that. I saw children dropping down in front of me and dragging themselves across the floor, covered in flies. Children you wouldn't ever expect to see like that. I mean, they were starving and skeletal, and on top of that, they were covered in flies and sores. So, you know, how can I believe in somebody created this universe, but it couldn't have been one man?
Before we just move to the audience, let me ask you one last question. If someone in their late teens wanted to become a photographer today, what advice would you give them?
I would say forget it, really, because if you see what's going on in our newspapers today, present company excluded, of course.
We do run the occasional photograph.
Yeah, but I'm always angry when I see the same successful people. You know, I shouldn't drop names, I suppose I have done for my sins, but I'm sick and tired of looking at those who've made it and who are incredibly rich and you know, cared for. Every weekend they're popping up, and nobody wants my pictures of wars and revolutions or, you know, underprivileged, starving and dying people. Mm. It's absolutely taboo. And many years ago I went...
Why is that, Don? What's
because
happened?
I don't think they sold newspapers.
You don't think some of these extraordinarily powerful pictures, photographs, sell?
No, I don't think so.
Have we become obsessed by celebrity? Is that?
Yes, we've become obsessed by. So it's more comfortable to have to run a newspaper that's giving you a glimmer of hope. But it's always the privilege and the people who are born with the looks and the great football skills
I can't imagine who you're talking about.
You're dying for me to say, aren't you? But I get angry when I don't see the... You know, I think that's why probably we're talking about fake news, really. We're getting all this narcissism. It's fake news, in a way. I don't want to become like Donald Trump. Even a man in Syria said to me when I was there last time, he said, "Are you related to Donald Trump?" And it's probably because of my hairstyle, yeah, you know, and my white hair. Yeah.
And, at least it's not orange, John, Don. But that's interesting. I mean, you really, because we're often told that the newspapers these days are just full of bad news.
Well, it's not very hopeful, the Brexit situation. Of course it's not, but all the other stuff. But, I mean, the good news is that ISIS is being cleaned up.
Yeah.
In the old days, one always felt that newspapers used to like sensational bad news to sell papers. But what we're having now is we're having sanitized-looking newspapers. I mean, I look at all the newspapers, the good, bad, and the awful, but I'm interested in world affairs. That's been my whole life. Indeed. I'm qualified to understand where the next oil is going to grow on the map. You know, I know where the next problem is going to come because I was always ready and packed, ready to go. But I not now, too old, but I don't think we're getting proper news anymore. Television news is rubbish. I watch the television news, I read everything. We're not getting the real story anymore. This is a whole new debate that you'd be better done with somebody else.
We're going to open up to the audience. I'm sure you've got lots of questions. Who would like to ask a question for Don? Please, gentleman in the middle.
I'm a bit deaf, so you may have to.
Why don't you just...
Is the microphone on? Great. Don, can I just say thank you so much for everything. I have my deaf aids in as well. Can I just say, in my mind, you are the greatest living Englishman. I mean, everything you've done is absolutely extraordinary. My question is, having witnessed what you've witnessed, is there a glimmer of optimism that you have for the human condition?
Right. So, Don, you are the greatest living photographer. You can deal with that.
I don't think so.
English photographer, oh, okay. Sorry. I'm going deaf. I've got a hearing problem too, actually. But having seen, witnessed everything that you have, do you still have some glimmer of optimism about the human condition?
None whatsoever. I apologise for my deafness. I got blown off once in Cambodia. My ears gone. I am not the greatest living, even English photographer. There were great, great photographers who lost their lives. Friends of mine. I rostered the Cambodian War in 1970. About 15 journalists were captured a week before I got there, and most of them disappeared. We found lumps of their flesh on the road. Me and some other people. One of them was a very close friend of mine. We were very competitive. And one day, he and I were standing in a field in Biafra, and a man came up to the commander and said, "What shall we do with the prisoners?" He said, "Kill them." And I was standing with my French friend, who was an ex-French soldier, quite tough, but very small and quiet. And he said to me, "I didn't hear that, did I?" I said, "No, I didn't hear it." And then the man gingerly went back to the commander and said, because we were going to run away. We were being beaten by the Nigerian army who were raining shells down upon us. And the man said, "Sir, about the police." I said, "Kill them." And then they started shooting. The men were crying and shaking. They were blindfolded. Thankfully, they couldn't look at us. And they eventually murdered them, killed them. And we ran away, and there were wounded men. There were men lying on the side of the road with their eyes hanging out, grabbing our legs as we ran by. We couldn't take them. It was either our lives or theirs. So, you know, you think, all I want to be is a photographer. I don't want to be anything special. I want to be a photographer. I want to do my job. I had a National Union of Journalists card. That's all I wanted to be, was a photographer. I didn't realize I was signing up for this great humanitarian experience and journey. So I may not answer your question properly, but I'm I don't want to sit here tonight just talking about photography, because it's not about photography, it's about humanity. And
The way you tell that, though, Don, you seem as though you were at one remove, but you couldn't have been. You needed to connect in some way to be able to take these wonderful pictures.
Well, there's also a technical collaboration, too. You have to get your exposures right. You're no good standing there and going back and finding you didn't look at your light meter properly. I had three light meters and three cameras, and I was in the war of Bangladesh. I was on the border where each night 10,000 people would come. They would move on the next morning and leave their dead children and their dead old people on the road. But there were the monsoon rain was coming, and each day I started losing one of my light meters. The rain got into the prisms of my cameras, and I remember sitting one day totally exhausted, and I was drinking tea out of a mud cup, and I had a banana, I was starving, and a boy was poking me in the arm, and he said, "Leave me alone, leave me." He kept saying, "Sir, sir, sir." And he was pointing, and I looked round, and I saw a man carrying his dying wife. So I threw my mug down, and I took this picture of this man carrying his wife, who was in the beginnings of cholera, because that's what was happening. Cholera, they were drinking this filthy water, yeah. And they were giving their children cholera, really. And I was so ashamed of myself, scolding that boy. He was pointing out this extraordinary image coming towards me. And I'm pleased to say that the woman in question did survive. They put her in a hospital, and I photographed her later on. She is one of the good, occasional good stories that come out of these experiences.
Yeah, it's all been, almost been an hour, and we just had a good story. Great. So in the middle, in the front, anywhere at the back.
It's been a pleasure listening to you talk tonight, so thank you for coming. I wanted to ask a question. I read an article recently which was describing the rediscovery of a few of the soldiers that were photographed in Vietnam, particularly the sniper, who I believe is a Scottish man, and there was another gentleman who was on top of a tank on a white door. And I just found that really interesting. I was wondering how you were talking about the way you weren't actually connected to them as buddies and friends, but how did that affect you kind of rediscovering the identities of some of these men that you photographed all those years before?
Right. Just to be clear, that this is a photograph in the exhibition.
Yes, there are two.
There are two, but this is one where there is a soldier on the... Because I can't... Couldn't
yeah, he's on a tank.
On a tank.
Yes.
You remember that?
Yeah, yeah, in fact, the New York Times ran, I think, in the last couple of days. There was a soldier that was hit in the chest by a sniper with the group of soldiers I was with in the Battle of Hue in the Tet Offensive, and he was taken to a tank and put on the tank, and he had the bullet struck his chest and came out of his hip. The velocity of bullets, they strike bones and they come out your neck or you can hit. And I got a letter from his mother and father saying, could you tell us the circumstances of... She didn't say he was dead, but we knew he was dead anyway. So a man has written a book about the Great Battle of Hue recently, a year ago nearly now, and he's claiming this man is still alive. So I'm now embroiled in trying to... the New York Times rang me the other night and said, we're fact-checking, and a man called Anthony Lloyd, who is the Times correspondent, who I've worked with very closely, he was, you know... People want explanations, you know, and it's difficult for me. I can't be all things to all men. I'm just a photographer. I'm not very well educated, so I'm not great with the letter writing, and I don't do computers, and I don't hardly use my mobile phone. So I've avoided the modern world. So, you know, am I responsible? And yes, I am, in a way. I'm responsible for easing their doubts about the death of their son. Why wouldn't they want to know? But the man who wrote the book, and you don't make mistakes in America as a writer, you don't make mistakes. They're constantly ringing you for checking. And so this writer is quite angry. This has all come up in his face. So, but, yeah. You know, once again, you know, one is put in a place, in a position that people ask you for responsible questions to be answered. I'm not always capable. Things happened 60 years ago, 50 years ago. I'm not capable.
Yes, sir. On the other side, and then gentlemen. Any late?
Is this on? Yeah. I was just wondering if you see any ways in which your earlier photojournalistic work impacted or affected the way in which you take landscapes, but also the way in which your landscapes might have impacted the way you've done later work in Ethiopia and Syria.
So did your early work in any way or in some ways influence your later work on landscapes or vice versa?
In my early work, I was on a journey of discovery. I was learning about photography, photojournalism, for the want of a better word. I was carried away. I was not as considerate with my thoughts that I, you know, when I saw the dying children in Biafra, that put the brakes on my kind of romanticism of war and the dashing hero running across the battlefield, which was nonsense, really. One day, a sniper tried to kill me, and he actually hit my camera, but I didn't hear the bullet hitting the camera. But I was running across this field, zigzagging. It's funny that I photograph fields now, but not fields of terror. I was running that day. I was lying in the slime of a rice field, and I thought, I'm not going to let this sniper get me. I could hear him. And I was zigzagging, and I could run like a lion when I was younger. And I thought, I don't want to be killed. I normally said that about all wars, but in the same war the night before, I saw some prisoners who were hand-tied at the back, and I gave them some chocolate. And the soldiers around me hated me for doing it. I thought if I was in their place, I would like some hope that I wasn't going to be, you know, maltreated or shot as many of those people were. So I'm constantly mixed up with my emotional, my thoughts about how I behave as a decent person. You know, photography is not the be-all and end-all, really. I've made a name out of photography, but I hope I've made the name out of photography by sheer hard labour in my darkroom. You know, hours and hours in the darkroom, making those prints next door. I've always tried to exonerate what I know is a certain amount of guilt that I'm carrying around.
The moral guilt.
Moral guilt is the my biggest foe, the moral guilt, because I made a name out of other people's suffering. So I turned to the landscape to try and ease the criticism that would eventually come. I mean, people have been quite generous to me, really. They haven't really said, why did you do this? Why didn't you do that? You know, I could have had a lot of criticism. I mean, there's still time. But so I turned to the landscape, and the landscape, in a way, there's nobody there to challenge me but the trees and the rain and the wind, and I feel almost poetical standing in the landscape. And by the way, that's under terrible threat as well. Everything I look at or touch is under threat. People write me letters and say, I want to be a war photographer, and that really angers me. So I say to these people, yes, that's okay, go out into the cities and see the homeless and the poor people. There's plenty of social wars. You don't have to get on an airplane at London Airport to go and see somebody else's suffering. It's here in this country.
Gentlemen, then is there a woman in the
audience? I remember the power that your images had 50 years ago when I used to go at midnight to buy the Sunday Times to see your latest shots there. But that was a time when there wasn't so many images around, and your images were very forceful as well. I think one of the problems today, and I'd like your view on this, is that we're absolutely bombarded with images everywhere on your phone, you know, all the time, in every possible circumstance. And in a way, images lose some of their power, sadly. How can we get back to a position so that images can have the power that they deserve, because your images are truly powerful?
I've never seen, and never want to see, the things you can see on telephones, the pornography. I don't know how to use my phone, thank God. I've never seen the beheadings of ISIS and people like that. I don't want to see them. And I think it should have been shut down Are you saying we should still be kept informed?
Yes, I mean, it's just, I remember as a young man going out and buying the Sunday Times at midnight so that I could see your latest shots from Vietnam and so on, and the power that those had in the society of the late 60s, early 70s. I fear those kinds of shots today, however well taken by yourself or anybody else, would have, I think, less power, simply because we are bombarded by images, not necessarily of horror images, but just images of all sorts at every turn. And in a way, you know, how I'm just trying to think, how can we make images have a resonance? How can the messages that you're trying to say come across in today's world?
So the problem is the saturation of images in the world today. I'm tempted to say, have an exhibition of Don's. No, maybe not.
Well, you know, I could be really criticised for having an exhibition of this illustrious house. But if I didn't, those pictures would stay in boxes in my house in Somerset. And I have to tell you that, without mentioning names again, but one day the editor walked into the Sunday Times magazine and said, there's going to be no more dying children in this magazine. We are now going to, you know, we're going to have a magazine that gives a bit of hope, and it's going to be about life and leisure. And this was a man who came under the Murdoch banner. And so... Sorry?
He said, was it Andrew Neil?
I never said that, but that was...
Anyway. I was there at the time, by the way, Don.
Oh, yes, I do. But then shortly after, I was fired. I got the sack. And it was like receiving a knighthood, you know. It was. I walked out of the Sunday Times. I remember turning my back on him and walking. He's a very clever man, Andrew. I'm not going to say anything bad about him. He denies he sacked me. But the truth is that I was...
It was an agreed departure, Don.
Pardon?
It was an agreed departure.
Well, the Guardian ran a... I did an interview with Granta magazine, and I said I felt like a man with a safari jacket on that wasn't never going on safari, because they put the stop to the warring. And Andrew saw it, and he said, I'm not having you take the money and criticize this newspaper, which he had the right to say, of course. So anyway, I left. And then, of course, I was 52 years of age. I was at a crisis in my life, all kinds of other... You know, we do have lives, photographers. We don't look at other people's tragedies. We have our own tragedies within our own framework of life. So, in a way, it made me dig a bit deeper and think, well, where do we go from here? 52, you know, normally people feel washed up at 52. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't. And I was determined, you know, to overcome this thing. I've never sought help from anybody, like repeating myself, psychiatrist people. I've always cured myself. And I got over it, and here I am. And
how did you cure yourself, Don? What were the qualities you drew on?
Well, I made some terrible mistakes. I married some terrible people. they cured me by making me destitute and broke. You know, so I was always looking.
I thought you'd been married to the newspaper.
I've always had to go it alone in life. But I grew up as a young boy, and I was sent to Somerset as almost an orphan during the war. And I slept in terrible houses as a child, on the floor, on mattresses. And I thought, I'm tough, I can do this, I don't need any. And in a way, my upbringing was better than any university could have ever taught me. I got through it I took the humanitarian. I felt sorry for myself sometimes, but I wasn't going to let it suffocate me. And I've lived my life through my work in my darkroom. And my darkroom is an amazing place because it's the best place you can analyze your world. You're looking at your work. Unfortunately, it's inconvenient when starving children are coming up in the developer. There's always a hurdle that one has to get over in life. And it doesn't apply to me. It applies to all of you out there. We all have these hurdles that we have to get over. And I don't want to lecture, but... I'm only here because I've stuck it up, really. And I love photography. It's been the worst mistress I've ever known. And I've clung to her or it. And I think I've been over-rewarded for it, really. I'm really. I was in my darkroom this Monday making prints, and every time I waste a sheet of paper, it's 20 quid. And I wasted 10 sheets on Monday. I felt so guilty. But I still have my hands in the developer, and I'm never going to stop.
Next question. Yes, ma'am.
Oh.
Almost.
That's okay. We're time to
do. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you very much, Don. Hi, can you hear me?
Cool.
So I thought it was very interesting hearing you talk about turning down the offer of a weapon. So my question was, did you ever accept that offer of a weapon? Did you ever carry a weapon? Or did you ever express any anger physically? There's a second part as well, which is what happened with the guy with the rucksack yesterday. You didn't tell us.
Well, what happened to the guy with the rucksack?
With the
rucksack that bumped into you yesterday.
Oh!
Yeah. He's still around, right?
I still have a bit of anger about people who push me around, and because I grew up to have that anger. But I shouldn't have it, really. But on the other hand, I've got lots of anger in me, really. I think about the terrible things I've seen. And by the way, the guy who offered me the weapon, if someone offers me a weapon, it means they're in trouble as well. They need the extra hand, you know. I won't.
So you've never, ever accepted a weapon?
No. A lot of people say to me, do you ever hide behind the camera? Well, it's like trying to hide behind that glass of water. You do hide, not behind the camera. You hide behind the morality of yourself and your presence. And the more and more I think about it, I think if I was to go too far into this, I think I could start going a bit mad, really. But I'm quite balanced, and I just don't like people with rucksacks.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Can we have a... Surely we've had all men asking the questions. Can we have something, a little bit of diversity here? I can't see anybody. Thank you.
You mentioned that you wish you'd taken the photograph of the East German soldier jumping over the wall. Are there any other photographs by other photographers that you wish you'd taken?
You wished you'd taken the photograph of the German, East German soldier jumping the wall.
Yeah, he never got... Yeah.
Tell us about that, and also any other photographs, the great missed photographs that you never took, that you wished you had.
Well, the great missed photographs never belonged to me in the first place. The East German soldier, I know exactly the street he was on when he jumped over the wire. It's called Bernaustrasse in Berlin, and he committed suicide a couple of dozen years ago. So he never found his place in the world after all. But, I mean, photography doesn't belong to you. I knew the man who took the photo of the police chief in Saigon shooting the man in the head. That was taken in 1968, but the war didn't end until 7 years later. That was one of the most shocking pictures of the war, and the girl running down the road. They didn't stop the war. You know, and the man who took the headshot picture said to me, I hate that picture. He said, all the work I did previous has been totally eradicated. It was the most amazing picture you've ever seen, that picture. It did not stop the war. The war went on raging for another 7 years. So I don't envy anything that belongs to another person, like the best picture of the world. I grew up loving a man called Alfred Stieglitz, who lived in New York in the turn of the last century. And I drew all my inspiration from Stieglitz and Steichen. And there's a wonderful man called Peter Emerson who photographed the Norfolk Broads. And they were pictures of simple people going around kind of rural kind of engagement, things like that. Why did I become a person involved in violence and war? I just don't know. There's always a tendency for me to think of the past and not the present and the future. I don't think about the future, not at my age anyway.
Okay, next question. One at the back there and then in the front. Yeah.
Hi. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I just wanted to know if you'd ever been tempted or wanted to experiment with colour in your
ever interested in experimenting with colour?
I've got 20,000 colour transparencies in my house, so I've never can't be accused of not experimenting. But I never thought pictures of war needed colour. I've always used black and white because I think it's like an immediate punch in the face when you see it. By the way, I'm slightly disappointed. This audience is full of women, and women detest war more than any other human beings. Women bring children into this world. They detest war. I can't remember too many women who have been responsible for too many wars, apart from, sadly, the woman in Burma who's turning a blind eye because she's controlled by the military. Aung San Suu Kyi. I think most of us have been disappointed with this woman, but she's controlled by the military. But it's amazing that women's anger should be greater than anybody else in about wars because, you know, they bring children into the world and they don't start wars. Mm.
You used a very telling phrase just now about the wanting to have the impact of a punch in the face. That's your signature tune, isn't it?
Well, I don't mean to be vicious, it wasn't a very nice way to phrase it. But when people look at my pictures, I want you not to walk past them and forget them. When I was a boy, I saw the first publications of the Holocaust victims in Belsen. The first books were being published when I was about 15. I looked at those pictures, and they still have a very strong bearing on my imagination. And so, but the pictures I take, they're just as bad, but I dress them up in a way that I can hold your attention a bit longer so that you can make up your mind exactly the way, you know, you feel about them. But I don't take pictures for people to walk past and not remember.
The front, yeah. And then gentlemen there.
Well, I came here this evening because my husband was a television journalist who covered many wars, and he's a great admirer of yours. I came only for that reason, but now I've heard what you say, I think that the man behind the camera is important. What you've said tonight has taught me a lot and made me think twice about one or two things. I'm too and very vulnerable to what I see and what I hear, and you've made me feel it does take more than just holding a camera, and I'm very, very pleased I came.
Okay. Well, to summarise, essentially, Carol's just discovered that there is somebody with a human spirit and heart behind the camera, not just a kind of unfeeling presence.
I can really jack this up in a much better way. There's somebody here tonight who did one of the greatest human acts of kindness in this room. And there was a terrible situation in Bangladesh. I covered the refugee situation, but there was a terrible case of retribution once the Bangladesh war was open, and they took a whole load of people to the stadium in Dakar, and they were torturing them by cigarettes in their faces before they got around to killing them. There's somebody in this room who was there with a television crew who walked away and would not film it. And I think that's the most honourable act you could do. And, you know, if I'd have been that person, which I wasn't because I wasn't there, it would have been a very tricky situation. Do you stay and you photograph it and you encourage it, or you walk away? The man in this room walked away, and that was the greatest human act that anyone could perpetrate and the most decent thing, because sometimes we are there in front of these people, and I can't help saying the way I feel about it, that we must occasionally help to perpetrate other people's suffering. So, you know, we occasionally have moral obligation to sort this out there and then, and this person sorted it out there and then and walked away with another friend of mine, and it's such a noble thing to have done.
It's interesting because I can still remember a conversation I had with an editor, an American editor, 25 years ago, and he said, no, the job of the journalist is just to put it out there and let the people decide. And that's surely not always correct. No, there is that moment when you may have to exercise restraint, or what some people might say, self-censorship.
Well, I think this man in question was obviously trying to exonerate his own thoughts on that. We did that at the Sunday Times. We would lay the pictures out, not me, the art director would lay them out. He knew he was giving you a bad time on Sunday morning. I mean, you could say it wasn't his obligation to force this stuff down your throat, but I mean, at the same time, there has to be some censorship, not anywhere near total, but, you know, who is responsible for saying what's right and what's wrong? You know, after all, our Sunday newspapers are often shared by our children, but I think our children now are getting a bigger dose of awfulness from their telephones when we're not there. So we're in a really bad place right now. I'm kind of glad I'm now too old to play the role I used to play, because I can't be blamed for anything anymore. You know, I'm not in the blame game anymore.
Last question. At the back, the gentleman who... Yeah. Just, sorry, I'm wrong. I thought it was someone else. I thought... Okay, you've drawn the lucky draw.
Did they put any batteries in those things?
No, it's public spending cuts.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, thinking more of your pictures of not war zones, but of people, for example, the ones in this country, and from your experience, do people react differently now years ago in having their picture taken? Cameras are much more around nowadays, and do you find yourself having to seek consent to take their picture more? Are they more amenable? Are they?
So do people react differently today when having their picture taken compared to, say, in the 60s?
People are much more aware of... They're a bloody nuisance to me, those people with their phones. They're always photographed. I mean, everybody's entitled to be, you know, take photographs, not just me. And it's good in a way that people are recording their lives, really. So I think people are more sympathetic about photography today, but they don't understand the kind of photography that I work in. And I'm in a totally different journey to those people. It's very... I'm glad I don't have to start all over again in my life. If I was a young man, I would probably become another Karl Lagerfeld or somebody like that. Somebody.
I can't see you holding a pussycat. Chouette, Dom. Please.
Photography, it's gone in another direction. You know, first of all, let's talk about the money. There's a photographer in America who takes pictures of kind of fire hoses and things like that, and the everyday life in American suburbia, and makes millions of dollars just doing these awful, boring color pictures. I could have gone down that road. It's called the art world, and every photographer in America now calls himself an artist, and I detest the name. I am a photographer. I'm not a photojournalist. I'm just a photographer. It suits my purpose. I don't want to be an artist. I do compose my pictures the best way I can. And I do it because I want people to stop and stare.
But you don't think that over the years you've developed an artistic tendency?
I visit art galleries and I look at the work of great painters like Caravaggio, whose lighting... I remember once photographing a baby in Vietnam. A baby came out of nowhere during this big battle in Hue, and the soldiers tenderly took that baby. It had a great lump out of its forehead. It was about that big. No trousers on, nothing. And they carried that baby down into this bunker, and they all held candles. And it was like a Caravaggio lighting. I was using film. It was too slow. The negative is almost too thin to make the picture. But I was looking at something. See, I make the mistake of using the word holy. This was a holy, beautiful scene of tenderness And it was being carried out by men who were killing other men upstairs on the battlefield. And they carried this child the next morning away from the bunker, and I photographed this big, huge Marine carrying this baby, and he was crying. And I could see this picture, and the picture reminded me, because when I'm taking pictures, I have an amazing memory for other great pictures I've seen. There's a picture of the Second World War taken by Robert Capa of a French woman carrying a baby whose head had been shorn because of a Nazi collaboration with a German boyfriend or what have you. But, you know, sometimes things in life repeat themselves. When people are dying and they're looking up and they're... It's Goya, it's Caravaggio, it's all there. It's things I've seen in these museums. So in a way, I've stolen other people's moments and stuffed them in my camera and pressed that button. But I don't think that's a crime, really. It's something that I've seen, and it automatically becomes part of my skin, my thinking, my eyes. My eyes have been my greatest gift, and you don't need a brain to have a good pair of eyes.
Don, you've given us so much tonight to think about. I want to thank you on behalf of all the guests here for your unvarnished and often raw honesty about the work you've done, but also to thank you for some extraordinary images that you've not just taken and showed us on screen, but through your own accounts of these extraordinary experiences you've had in the field of conflict. Thank you.
Thank you.